Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Is war inevitable? We're asking prominent thinkers about war and peace. And we're asking you, can human beings ever stop fighting wars? We will ask Chris Hedges and Barbara Ehrenreich in just a minute. First, to remind you about this series, we were inspired by the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, finally, and by John Horgan's new book, The End of War, to spend some time this year asking one of the ultimate questions. Can we ever lay down our swords and shields for good? Here's a little excerpt from part one of the series 2 weeks ago with John Horgan, the science journalist who proposes in his new book, The End of War, that war is merely a human invention, and we could invent something to replace it. He says war is not part of our DNA.
I think it's important to look at the evidence from human archaeology and anthropology. And there I think that the evidence points clearly to the conclusion that war is a quite recent behavior. It doesn't go back hundreds of thousands, let alone millions of years. It really only started emerging 10 to 12,000 years ago, especially first in Mesopotamia, in Asia, and the Middle East, and then rapidly did spread around the world.
And John Horgan says war is not inevitable. Now, as you might imagine, most people are not as optimistic as John Horgan. In fact, he has asked thousands of people if they think we can abolish war, and 80 to 90% say no. Younger people say no even more than older people, meaning pessimism, not optimism, is rising based on this generation's experience. But still, Horgan believes a better understanding of where war came from will help us better understand how to abolish it. And so we turn today to two writers of books on the origins of war, both of whom Horgan refers to in his book. First, Barbara Ehrenreich, best known for Nickel and Dimed and other writing on class and work. She also wrote a book called Blood Rights in 1996, arguing that humans learned war early as a means of self-defense against animal predators back in hunter-gatherer times. This, she says, has led to kind of a religion of war. Barbara, thank you for taking part in the series with us, and welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we'll get to Chris Hedges in just a couple of minutes, too. And listeners, we are asking you, too, is war inevitable? Go to WNYC.org/endofwar. And I'll ask you the John Horgan question later, Barbara. Do you think we can abolish war? But first, you were on the show for a book interview way back when Blood Rights came out 15 years ago, 16 years ago. Can you remind us briefly of your argument that the culture of war came from self-defense against animal predators?
Well, I wouldn't say the culture. I would say some of the emotions. I think we leave out way too often in our notions of human evolution the fact that we were once in trouble. We're a weak species that is physically weak. We don't have tusks or strong teeth or horns or claws. We had to make our way in an environment which contained far more animals and far more predatory animals than exist now in our depopulated world, or depopulated in terms of animals. So, that confronting these non-human threats meant the need to band together, for the group to cohere. What I suggest is that this involved a lot of excitement, a passion that could even lead people to self-sacrifice for the group. In the face of the leopard or whatever the encroaching threat was.
And that word passion is right in the subtitle of your book. It's Blood Rights, Origins and History of the Passion of War.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what the relationship is, as you see it, between the practical material matter of surviving the predators with tusks and something that we make passionate, or as you put it in the book, that we make sacred, we sacralize war. What's the relationship between that practical material matter of survival and sacralizing something or becoming passionate about it?
Well, that's a long question. It's a big question. But I would point out that some of the earliest religions, if we can even call them religions, because that includes a certain amount of assumption right there in the word religion, but some of the earliest forms of worship that people had were for animal predators. The earliest gods, the earliest deities, were often lion-shaped or associated with some other dangerous predator. Now, I just want to say, Brian, though, that because I'm saying, that these passions of war are very, very ancient, and this is going back earlier than when John Horgan is talking about the actual outbreak of war, doesn't mean we're stuck with them. I think that that history of predation by carnivorous animals left its mark in many ways. We have nightmares. We go to horror movies so that we can watch people be stalked and even torn into bits, and then reassure us that we're still okay. I think it left a lot of marks on us, and it doesn't mean it's not destiny that we have to keep doing the same thing. We can get some of the same excitement banding together against a common enemy at a football game.
Sure, and it's been a long time since we had to worry about lions and tigers and bears. Now we name football teams after them, and we make cuddly stuffed animals out of them. So why do you think we haven't dropped the obsolete impulse?
No, I think that what you have to face is that war is not an impulse in individuals. I can't get up in the morning and say, gee, I feel like having a war today. War is a highly complex, organized activity. Even in a small, band of people, you've got to get the arrowheads sharpened. You've got to decide who's doing what. You have to have a little bit of a plan. In our time, it's a massive undertaking. I don't think there is any larger collective undertaking that humans have ever done on the scale of war. And so, I may have an impulse to fight, or an impulse to, stop all fighting, to be a pacifist, doesn't matter. These things are now institutionalized.
Also with us now, Chris Hedges, for 15 years, a New York Times war correspondent who covered conflicts in the Balkans, Central America, and the Middle East. In 2002, during the run-up to the Iraq War, he released a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking part in our End of War series. And I think you know Barbara Ehrenreich, who is also still with us.
Yes.
And
thank
you. I'm struck by how you and Barbara and John Horgan all argue that war comes less from hatred or aggression than from altruism, the positive desire to serve one's community. Can you talk about how much you believe that's the case?
I don't know that that would be quite my argument. I would say that the intoxication of war, the attraction of war, is a crowd phenomena. It allows people to overcome feelings of inadequacy, loneliness, alienation. You build that kind of comradeship, which is different from friendship, but I think mistaken for friendship, where you have a full sense of equality and egalitarianism. This comes with the perceived or real threat of an external enemy. You have the notion of our weapon systems or our armies as being an extension of personal power. You see that on all the cable news shows when they bring on retired generals and colonels who explain the power of weapon systems. And I think the sort of unsaid or unspoken message is, by extension, our own personal power. There are very powerful forces that make war deeply seductive. And I write that, war at its inception feels and looks like love, the chief emotion that, of course, war destroys. When you see gatherings of combat veterans, what they're seeking to recreate is not the experience of combat, which is venal and dirty and awful, but I think those feelings of comradeship. Because once that external threat is gone, once you know, these bands dissipate, all these comrades again become strangers. And I think that there are powerful forces at work that make war and have always made war throughout human history deeply enticing, to such an extent that societies can embrace it, even when it is, at a certain point, assures their own self-annihilation. This was certainly, for instance, true in Serbia at the end of the war, and I think you can go back and, you know, certainly after 1943, that was true in Hitler's Germany as well, and I think the movie Downfall captured that those kinds of emotions. So Freud was right, at least to my thinking, that there aren't always two powerful pulls. Eros, that instinct to preserve, conserve, protect, and nurture human life, and Thanatos, that death instinct that calls for the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. And Freud argued that these two forces were in eternal conflict, both within the individual and within the society at large. And usually one was ascendant. So I think that the altruism, the kind of self-sacrifice that you mentioned, which of course is part of war, I take a much bleaker view. I look at it as a kind of a seduction of the death instinct.
Barbara, have you thought about that? Can I get you right back in on that question?
Well, yeah, I think I would differ a little bit in that we don't always or people don't always have a choice about war. If you are a peaceable band of people, and you know, 12 miles down the river there is another band of people that is really warlike and has developed a warrior group within itself, you know, you don't have a big choice. At some point, you have to arm and be prepared to fight them, or you're eliminated. And now I'm not saying, you know, that could be used, of course, to justify any war. You could say, oh, well, we had to fight Saddam Hussein or he would have killed us or something. But I'm just saying that there is a pull to war that does not have to do with our feelings, with our passions or excitement. That can be, there's a kind of, let's say, a weight of militarism. Once militarism was set loose, and I agree with Horgan that was, you know, probably with the emergence of the Neolithic in about 12,000 years ago, once that set loose, pretty much everybody, not all societies, everywhere, but you've got to get with the program, at least if you're going to live in any kind of vicinity of warlike people.
Yeah, and Chris Hedges, to that point, one of the reasons that Horgan is an optimist, if I understand him correctly, is that he says our relationship to war has changed from war itself being a source of honor in society, honor and pride, to being seen as a necessary evil, that kind of self-defense that Barbara was just talking about. Do you buy that?
No. And first, let me address Barbara's point. She's certainly right. And you could, in the sense that people have to react. I mean, this is how, for instance, the besieged population in Sarajevo had to react to Serbian forces that clearly wanted to use the remnants of the old JNA, the Yugoslav army, the armor and the heavy weapons, to take over all of Bosnia. And either they armed themselves and literally, I was in Sarajevo during the war, built trench systems, I mean, it's like World War I, around the city to defend themselves, or they ended up like the ethnic Muslims in the Drina Valley, who were, you know, about one third of whom were killed, and the rest of whom were driven into displacement or refugee camps, and had all of their villages overrun and dynamited into rubble. So we knew what would happen. The problem is that once that outside aggressive force begins to make moves against a population that doesn't want war, it empowers those elements within that population. So that the first defenders of Sarajevo came from the criminal class. They were gangsters, cello, these kinds of figures who had a penchant for violence and an access to weapons. They became the first war heroes. And so the poison of war did not upset itself, even in a supposedly just cause or even when it was embraced by a population that did not want to go to war. It's the same disease, and it lurks within every human society. Secondly, the notion that we don't make heroes, I just don't buy that at all. I mean, I think this is a culture utterly saturated in not only the glorification of violence, but the elevation of a militaristic figures, whether it's Schwarzkopf or whoever we're picking out, Petraeus. These people are treated almost like deities by the press, by the two parties, even people who don't support the wars. I think that hero worship is deeply alive. And when you see it on the look at the whole sort of creation of the Pat Tillman story. I mean, we know it was a fabrication, the fabrication of Jessica Lynch. There is a thirst and a hunger for war heroes, which is why the media and the public relations industry that works for the Pentagon and the state churns it out, why they created false narratives for both Tillman and Lynch, because it sells the war.
Do you think, well, your recent book is Death of the Liberal Class, and I haven't read it, I have to admit, but do you approach the war question in there? Because some people, even when we said that we were going to do this series and talk about the potential of human beings ending war at some, you know, undetermined point in the future, some people said, God, that's so pie in the sky. Why are you even doing a series on that? And yet it seems to me there was a time when people talked about ending war. Is this part of the death of the liberal class?
Yes, because what you're talking about is that vision before World War I, whether it was Rauschenbusch and the social gospel, whether it was the muckrakers. I mean, they all had this kind of vision of human progress that was shattered by World War I. And, of course, World War I becomes a seminal point on many levels, one being that it was used by the Wilson administration and the robber baron class to destroy radical movements. And Randolph Bourne and Jane Addams have written quite eloquently about this. And the way they used it was war, was the kind of permanent war psychology. Dwight MacDonald writes correctly that World War I was the rock on which progressive movements broke. And he said that's because social and political theorists, including Marx, had did not envision the kind of sickness of permanent war which enveloped American society in World War I and afterwards. Because, of course, once the war ended, the dreaded Hun became the dreaded Red, which was led to the Palmer raids, the shutdown of the masses, appeal to reason, the destruction of the Wobblies, et cetera, plus the hollowing out of liberal institutions like the ACLU, the universities, culminating in the 1950s, thousands of people losing their jobs, all in the name of this, ferreting out the internal threat, those who were either hidden communists or soft on communists. I think that war, it's deeply enticing. And when you read Bourne or you read Addams, one of their laments is how even socialists, were seduced by the war to end all wars, the war to make the world safe for democracy, all the kind of slogans that were put out by this powerful propaganda machine, the Committee for Public Information or the Creel Commission, which employed the understanding of mass psychology pioneered by Le Bon, Trotter, Sigmund Freud. I mean, Edward Bernays, right, the father of modern public relations, is Freud's nephew twice over. They all go from the Committee of Public Information straight to Madison Avenue. And I think at that point we become a culture utterly awash in lies, enveloped by the sickness of a permanent war kind of psychology or psychosis.
That's a pretty dark vision. But to that backdrop, we will take a break and then return and ask you the John Horgan question directly, both Chris Hedges and Barbara Ehrenreich, and that is, do you think humans can ever put an end to war? Is war inevitable? And listeners, we have a webpage where you can answer that question for yourself. Is war inevitable, or can human beings ever put an end to war? Go to WNYC.org/endofwar, and we'll continue with Barbara Ehrenreich and Chris Hedges on this in just a minute.
Well, I'm gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my burden down by the riverside. Study.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue our series, The End of War. Is War Inevitable? Again, John Horgan, author of the book, The End of War, from our program 2 weeks ago, on one reason that he is an optimist.
One of the reasons why I'm optimistic at this particular point in history is because there are some cultural trends that I think are really pointing in the right direction. A really powerful one is the spread of democracy. So a century ago, only about 10% of humanity lived under democracy. Today, depending on how you count it, it might be about two-thirds of the human population. And there is a finding in political science that suggests that democracies just don't wage war against each other, or they are much less likely to. Another positive trend, I think, is the emergence of media, which points out the horrors of war more than ever before. I do think that female empowerment, which we were discussing earlier, is another positive trend. So all these different things are converging, I think, to bring us to the point where we can talk about renouncing war once and for all.
John Horgan, author of The End of War, starting off this series 2 weeks ago. And listeners, we are collecting your answers to the question, is war inevitable? Post your responses to our End of War page at WNYC.org/endofwar. Just a small sampling of what we've gotten in the first 2 weeks of this series. Joe C. writes, I'm afraid so. Yes, war is inevitable. There is just too much money to be made, win, lose, or draw. Dr. Alai, on the other hand, writes, I am inclined to write that no, war is not inevitable. Man is hesitant to kill, and it takes systematic conditioning to enable him to wage war. But even that conditioning is temporary. War is not inevitable. And the scientist Steven Pinker posted an answer. He says, as I argue in a recent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, I think that the causes of war, human avarice, short-sightedness, vengeance, dominance, tribalism, and self-deception will always be with us, but that wars may not be. The more institutionalized the practice, as in human sacrifice or chattel slavery, the easier it is to abolish, and big interstate wars are highly institutionalized. Hence, the decline we've seen since 1946 could very well continue until the practice no longer exists, writes a hopeful Steven Pinker. Still with us are Barbara Ehrenreich, whose books include Blood Rights About Human Warfare, published in 1996, and Chris Hedges, former New York Times war correspondent, who wrote War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, published in 2002, and is also the author of The Recent Death of the Liberal Class. So with the backdrop of those responses, Barbara Ehrenreich, now let me ask you the John Horgan question directly. Do you think war is inevitable, or can human beings ever stop fighting wars?
Yes, I think we can stop. I think it's not inevitable. However, I think to stop it, we have to have a better idea of what we're up against than I think comes through in Horgan's book. Or even, you know, here I might disagree with Chris a little bit, just talking about it as a sickness, as a psychology, as a kind of culture, seems to me to be a little bit mystifying a part of what's going on. When you have the means to war, they tend to get used. There's a wonderful quote from a recent book about the Roman Empire, which was just viciously aggressive, where the author writes, Rome just had to give all these soldiers something to do. You know, when you have the army, when you have the siege machinery, when you have the cavalry and everything, they tend to get used. And that's one of the things about World War One, which did, you know, as Chris said, excite a huge burst of passion, even among pacifists and socialists, is that you had a lot of very heavily armed nation states that had not had much use for their militaries for a while. Well, there'd been the Boer War, but it had been a relatively peaceful time for quite a while. So there is a kind of pressure that just comes from having that military, having all those generals with their egos, as Chris mentioned, having drones and all the other things. There is, you know, we have to look at that. We have to see that that also affects how we, you know, whether we go to war again or war or not, and it is separate from our immediate human feelings.
Chris, is war inevitable?
Yeah. Look, I mean, we are living through a time where there is no rational check on serious climate change. We are spending down our natural capital at an alarming rate. Issues as basic as water and crop yields. I mean, the agronomists say that for every 1 degree rise in temperature, it's a 10% loss in crop yields. Human societies, when they break down, when they don't have access to basic commodities, will engage in aggressive behavior to attempt to survive. With the shredding of Kyoto, the failure at Copenhagen, the utter blindness to address what the fossil fuel industry is doing, not only to the country, but finally to the planet, I think we are, in fact, entering a time where there will be an increase of conflict, scrambling for depleted resources as groups, including nation states, attempt to survive. I think Barbara is correct that, when you build up huge defense establishments, as we have done, they tend to get used. There becomes that old maxim that, you know, when you have the capacity to wage war, you somehow believe you have the right to wage war, which is how we ended up in Iraq and Afghanistan, and how we have decided now to wage proxy wars in Yemen and Pakistan and Somalia. If you look at the demilitarization of American society following the Civil War, we managed, at least until the resurrection of the war machine for the occupation of Cuba, we have to sort of look at the genocide of Native Americans as a war. But there was a revulsion after the Civil War towards all things military. And I think that often happens after wars. Unfortunately, every generation seems to have to learn this lesson for itself. And I'm all for, massive disarmament. And I think that that is a good check on, expansionist tendencies and imperial projects. And yet at the same time, I think that there are conditions that we are beginning to face that will make a physical scramble for survival necessary on many levels. And finally, when it comes to that choice between violence and acquiescence to extinction, people will choose violence.
Barbara, can you come back on this in relation to something that you wrote in Blood Rights, where you kind of proposed a war on war, if you will, a war on warfare? And I think you would generally agree with Chris's political analysis of what's going on in the world today. And yet you came to the conclusion that permanent warfare is not inevitable as part of the human condition. So would there be a way to fight against these other conditions, these other global politics, these other global warming and natural resources issues, that you think could...
Let me just speak here for a moment for John Horgan, who's not with us. I reviewed his book, so it's fresh in my mind.
Yes.
But he did make an argument that resource depletion is not a cause of war. That's, you know, he goes through all the things that people have assumed to cause war, such as, you know, well, he doesn't use the word testosterone, et cetera. And then he, you know, resource depletion. But he offers plenty of empirical reasons to think that is not a driving force. We do have some choice in it. Now, you're right, Brian. I said somewhat, it may seem a little paradoxically, that we need to fight war, that we have to look at it in a somewhat warrior spirit and say, what exactly is it? What are we up against? If we're up against a human psychological flaw, all right, that's one thing. I'm saying no. I'm saying there's something, there's a kind of a way in which war reproduces itself, and Horgan says the same thing, so that it goes on from generation to generation. And we have to dissect all the ways that it keeps coming back, that it keeps reproducing itself, and uproot them one by one.
Let's get some callers' voices in on this. We haven't even given out the phone number, and our lines are packed. People have such an interest in this. We've been having record numbers of comments posted on our End of War pages. 212-433-WNYC for Barbara Ehrenreich and Chris Hedges. Aaron in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
I think two quick issues. One is we've had this push since the Neolithic era to scale warfare until the 20th century when we, you know, had 100 million in continental Europe, 100 million in Africa, 200 million in Asia, directly and indirectly killed, plus another 100 million spread everywhere else.
And Aaron, just let me say before you continue, just so I can put you in a little bit of context for the listeners, you told our screeners that you are a combat vet from Iraq?
Yes, sir. And so we've had scalable warfare in this century, which has been this march for really thousands, you know, 10, 15,000 years. And we're never going to have a half a billion people killed directly and indirectly in warfare in another large context like we had mechanistically. So high scalable warfare is over in the context that we live in the world. And the second thing is with worldwide economic development increasing 100-fold this last century, it's likely to continue to increase, maybe not to that same degree, but to a very high level. Large-scale warfare is over. Now, will we have warfare? Yes. Will we have conflicts? We probably will have a huge fragmentation in many of them. But the idea that we're going to have wars like we had in the 20th century, and we're going to have a mechanistic culture of warfare that we've had over thousands of years, when you combine it with the economic development, people in the end don't go to war for the same resource reasons they went to war directly like we did thousands of years ago. We don't scale warfare the same way for the same reasons. You know, we don't conquer North Africa just to conquer North Africa. You know, things are very, very tactical now. And that doesn't mean warfare is good. That doesn't mean conflict is good. That doesn't mean any individual who dies, you know, says, oh, I didn't die on a scalable war, so the world's better. But what it means is that we're not going to have the same scale of violence. It's impossible in our history to depopulate 10 to 20% of a century's population. We're just never going to do that.
Aaron, could I ask you briefly if war was a force that gave you meaning when you were fighting in Iraq, to quote the title of Chris's book?
Look, what gives you meaning are the people you're around on the team you're in. At the moment, it's just like whether you're on a sports team or you're on a squad in the military, or you're in some endeavor that you feel you're dependent on other people.
Which is exactly his point, I think, about camaraderie and fighting for your team more than fighting against the other guy.
When someone's shooting at you, you're fighting against the other guy, too. So, yeah. It's a little bit of both. When you're sitting around not doing anything, it's teamwork. When, it's a very unifying, feeling when, when you hear a little bit of steel go by you. So, that's a very different thing. But practically speaking, you don't kind of build a war culture because we like having sports teams. I mean, at the end of the day, warfare is policy. It's always been policy. Von Clausewitz, you know, stated that, and in the end, you know, it's proven itself. Now, has it been good policy? You know, probably more often than not, no. But it's still always policy and politics that drives warfare modern eras.
Hang on for a second. My producer wants to ask you a question, and thank you very much for calling in. Chris, I want to get quickly to another caller, but do you have a quick reaction to Aaron?
Well, I mean, both to Aaron and to Barbara. I mean, what was the war in Iraq about? It wasn't exclusively about dominating oil resources, but that was a major issue. And oil has become a huge factor as we are watching the Chinese and the Americans play a chess match around the world for control of these resources. So I just don't buy this notion that war is not about resources. Anybody who looks closely at the topography of the Middle East knows that water is huge. It's why the Israelis, for instance, in the occupation of the West Bank, have made sure they control all the aquifers. Resources are, you know, it's not the only issue for war. The war in Bosnia wasn't about resources. But resources have played, an issue in warfare. I mean, as you know, you look down in the breakdown of Easter Island, as it crumbled towards the end, that's what it was about.
Matt in Piscataway, you're on WNYC. Hello, Matt.
Hi. I just thought I would make the point that if you're going to do a thorough analysis of warfare, it's likely to be important not just to discuss communities that choose to exercise their versions of conflict in warfare, but also societies that, the counterexample, that there are societies that choose not to engage in warfare. So, my list in my head is not exhaustive, but, certainly you could talk about the Swiss, maybe the Canadians, for example. These are people who, in large part, don't engage in warfare, to exercise, conflict. Maybe diplomacy is their version of exercising conflict. I think it's important for the thorough analysis to have that discussion.
Matt, thank you.
Let me just throw that in as a Swiss citizen. The Swiss built one of the most effective standing armies in Europe. It was the only country that was not invaded by the Nazis, and Hitler famously said, "I could do it, but the cost would be too great." It wasn't because they were pacifists. They cut deals where the coal could run through from Italy on trains to the Nazi war machine. They served as the Nazi bankers, but they made it very clear that if the Germans crossed the boundaries, they would fight, and they would fight hard.
Are you really a Swiss citizen?
Yeah.
Do you think that, I don't know how, if you were raised there or what, do you think that informs your relationship to war?
No, I think what informs my relationship to war is 20 years of being in the midst of war.
Right.
It's not theoretical for me. I know what it feels like and looks like.
Barbara Ehrenreich, last word for today on Matt's idea. And John Horgan writes about also, societies. Costa Rica is another one that decided to give up its army, even though it was in the bad neighborhood of Central America, and the Waorani tribe, and et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yes, and that's all things we need to pay attention to. People can stop fighting. But I think there's something very important that the caller said, which is that war is beginning to be less labor intensive. We're unlikely to see hundreds of thousands of people fielded in wars again. In other words, it's being automated even as we speak. The drone trend is just part of it. The other part is that there's so much information coming in from surveillance technologies now, satellite-based surveillance technologies, that a human mind can't process it. So computers have to process it. And there's already talk in military circles about whether humans will even be able to remain in the loop. War may go on without us.
Barbara, if that was true, the Taliban would not be winning the war.
We will leave that as a provocative thought for a news conversation, probably later this week. Barbara Ehrenreich, author of many books, including Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America and Blood Rights, Origins and History of the Passion of War, and Chris Hedges, senior fellow at the Nation Institute and many book author, including his new one, Death of the Liberal Class and War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Thank you both for an extraordinary conversation.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And listeners, you can keep posting your responses to the question, is war inevitable, at our special webpage for this series at wnyc.org/endofwar. And coming up next, we continue to talk about our year without winter. Stay with us.